Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to ATI Financial Radio, a plain English, no-nonsense approach to personal finance. Today is Thursday, April 30th, and today's show is Common Insurance Mistakes. I'm Dina Isola, here today with Tony Isola, and we want to welcome you and thank you for joining us. Insurance coverage and policy types can be very tricky to decode. That's why many people don't realize that they don't have the insurance coverage they need. Today we're going to discuss some common insurance mistakes and how you can correct them. Are U.S. companies doing right by their employees? Today Tony is going to discuss his latest blog, Three Reasons Why Companies Should Invest in Workers and Not in Their Stock. Also today we're going to discuss and demystify GDP. What is it and what does it indicate? Consumers, we have some easy and repeatable tips to save you money that you can use year in and year out. And in the Kids Cash Corner, we will discuss how parents are guilty of failing to teach their children about money, and we will give you three ways that you can correct this in your own household. So let's start with the blog this week. It was kind of an interesting take. I don't know if many people are aware of what's going on in U.S. companies as they try to please shareholders and what it costs their employees.
Yeah, well, what's actually happening, one of the reasons that the stock market has continued to go up the past few years is companies are buying back their own shares. And what that does is it lowers the supply of shares available, and just supply and demand, with less shares available, they become more expensive to purchase. So there's nothing wrong with doing that if it's the best thing to do with their money. For instance, in 2009, when the market crashed, if companies stepped in and bought their shares, it probably would be a very intelligent decision. But just to kind of keep blindly buying back your shares and ignoring other types of investments is really not a sustainable strategy.
Well, and they're missing an opportunity to really strengthen their company by investing in their employees and what that means to them over the long
right.
term. It's very short-sighted they're doing.
It's very short-sighted. And what it does is basically the CEOs are mainly compensated by the price of the company's stock going up. So a short-term blip in the stock could greatly benefit the CEO. So his motivation is to get that stock price as high as possible because that's the way he gets paid. Now, what it ignores is the fact that money could have been went to retraining workers. It could go to hiring more workers. It could go into investing in research and development for better products. It could go into improving employees' retirement benefits to take a strain off of our Social Security and Medicare system. So there are a lot of ways that money could be spent by a company, but it just seems right now it's very disproportionate that most companies feel the best use of their money is to just continuing buying their stock and neglecting all the other options which could benefit the economy as a whole and the future of the country.
Well, I like how you wove in some historical reference by mentioning Henry Ford and how he was actually very forward-thinking, not just for his invention and his innovativeness, but also the way he viewed employees and how he treated them and how he saw that as an investment.
Yeah, I mean, Henry Ford was a capitalist, and his motivation was to make money, but he realized he'd make more money if he treated his workers better and paid them more. At one point, he had 14,000 workers, and he needed 50,000 workers to do the job because they were constantly quitting or leaving or breaking things or whatever was
stealing,
going on, stealing. So he realized if he paid them a decent wage, they would be much more loyal, they wouldn't leave, they would work better and be more productive. So, you know, he did this 100 years ago, and it worked. So I think some companies now, like Walmart and McDonald's, are starting to do it, but you're working from very, very low bases here. So for them to raise it, they really haven't raised things in a very long time. So there's a lot of work to do. But hopefully, I think in the future, this will probably start to change, and companies will realize more loyal workers and productive workers will be better, maybe, for the company's stock price in the long term than just short term buying back the stock blindly without even looking at the price. And in the end, that could hurt shareholders, because one of the biggest amounts of stock buybacks in history occurred in 2007, and that's right before the market crashed. So companies ended up losing, you know, a significant amount of money by making that decision.
You list basically three ways that companies can devote more resources toward their employees, as retirement benefits, wages, increasing their wages, and education. You want to elaborate a little bit on that? I know you referenced Australia as a model example for retirement benefits.
In Australia, you don't have a choice. It's mandatory that you contribute a portion of your salary toward your retirement. And in Australia, you know, they have about half as much amount of money in their total 401k plans as the United States. But the United States has 14 times more of the population. So with this combination of forcing people to save and the companies matching that amount and increasing the amounts, it could be a very good thing, not only for the companies and the workers, but for the government programs that are in existence to take care of people. It could take a burden off them by having people being able to take care of themselves.
So we discussed Henry Ford, and that really does kind of cover increased wages. And, of course, the obvious is if you pay your workers more, then they can also go out and purchase more goods. And in doing that, that is very stimulative on the economy.
Right, because 70% of our economy is based upon consumers purchasing goods. So the more money in consumers' pockets to spend is always a good thing.
Now, education was the third point you wanted to raise, and Starbucks is surprisingly pretty forward-thinking in that regard.
Starbucks is a very, very forward, you know, thinking company. You know, their CEO, his name is Howard Schultz. He came from Brooklyn in housing projects, and his parents never went to college, and he realized, you know, a lot of these people are stuck in jobs at Starbucks that they can never really get out of, you know, entry-level type, low-level jobs because they lack an education. So he set up a program where if you're an employee with Starbucks, they will pay for a college education for you. It's at an online school in Arizona State University, and if you qualify with the requirements, they will subsidize you as long as you're working there. And you don't have to pay the money back if you decide to leave Starbucks. So, you know, companies doing things like this, while it may cost a little money in the short term, could certainly benefit everybody in the long term. And again, creating more consumers, because I'm sure Starbucks realizes if they leave Starbucks and go somewhere else and make a lot more money, they'll probably still be customers of Starbucks. So everybody wins in the end.
So as a final thought, when companies decide to invest more in their employees, be it through retirement plans or wages or education, they end up really strengthening our economy because you end up with stronger consumers able to purchase more goods and services. And also, if the retirement plan is strengthened,
absolutely,
you're more people investing
means less taxes also for people going forward to subsidize, you know, government programs. The less people have to rely on the government for retirement benefits and medical benefits in the future, the better it will be for everybody. So again, highly paid, educated, and well-trained workers is never a bad thing.
Not at all. And if you want to read the full blog, it's on maliceforall.com.
Yeah, and it's also on Abnormal Returns, which is a very good website for financial articles and actually all kinds of things, and it's posted today in today's link. So if you went to abnormalreturns.com, you would see it there also.
Great. Okay, moving on to economics. This week, the GDP, or gross domestic product number, was released, which represents the broadest measure of goods and services produced in the U.S. It was a low rate. It projected a rate of, if you annualized it, it was a 0.2% growth rate.
Right. It was basically
flat.
Nothing. It basically showed very little change from the previous year's quarter. But what it does is it measures the value of all the goods and services produced, and it's the best way to judge kind of how your economy is growing. But, you know, you might have heard on the news yesterday, well, GDP is low, disaster, you know, economy's collapsing. That's very misleading because it's what you call a lagging indicator. It tells you what happened in the past, not what's going to happen in the future. And when you look at the GDP that just came out, it covered January, February, and March. Now, this was one of the coldest winters ever in the Northeast, one of the snowiest winters ever in the Northeast, which did tremendous damage to the economies over that time with home building and people shopping and things like that. So what tends to happen is the numbers are not very they tend to average out. So the next 3 months will probably be a lot better. It's already showing up in some of the numbers that are coming out recently as far as housing and things of that nature. So when you hear these numbers, you have to understand many of them are just judging what happened in the past, and you should never make investment decisions based on things that happened in the past. Investments are always about what's going to happen in the future. So when you hear bad numbers, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be bad for the market or bad for the economy. It means the economy could just simply be going through a temporary bad period with a rebound in the next quarter. Not to say that's going to happen, but you have to look at the numbers very closely to understand what's happening. And if you hear it on the news for 30 seconds, that's not really a good way to learn about things.
Great. Okay, on to the consumer tip. We have three good ways for you to start saving and implementing it right away. And they're really very evergreen, these tips. First of all, if you take inventory of what you need, you're less likely to impulsively buy. And also, if you're taking inventory, it also kind of means that you're looking at what you need. So we just came off winter, for example. If you know that, oh, gosh, you know, I broke the shovel or the snow blower or, you know, anything that relates to winter seasonal activity, even if it's holiday decorations or whatnot, now is a really great time to start looking at replenishing that. And if you do that, then you're not caught at the beginning of the next time that season rolls around paying top dollar, because if you purchase things now, you'll kind of scoop them up as you're trying to clear them out.
Yeah, it's the same thing too, like in the fall with gardening, and many perennial plants will go dormant and they kind of look like they're dead. They're not dead, they're just dormant, and you could purchase them for, you know, sometimes 10% or less of what they would cost you in the spring. So not only will you get a much better value, but you could purchase a lot more of them, plant them in the fall, and then in the spring they'll be ready to grow. And while everyone else is going out and spending $10 or $20 for a pot of perennial flowers, you could end up spending, you know, 50 cents or a dollar. And over the long term, that's obviously another good investment.
So buying off-season is a really great way to save money. I mean, there's even an investment strategy dedicated to that where you buy things after they've fallen out of favor called value investing. It's kind of the same concept, except you're doing it with goods. And also as part of taking inventory, you know, if you have a comprehensive list of things that you know are coming up, you know, there's maybe a graduation this year in your family or a birth of a child or someone going away to college or different birthdays, if you have kind of a roadmap of what lies ahead for the year, taking inventory will also help you with the third tip, which is buying in advance of your need. If you know, for example, someone is going off to college in the fall and you see a really great deal on sheets and comforters and things that you might have to pick up for that child, better to be doing it now than when everyone else is doing the back-to-school shopping and it becomes this crush and you're pressured and you may not buy using, you know, good sense. You may just pay extra just for the convenience of getting it over with as opposed to doing it at your leisure and getting a better deal. And, you know, the same holds true for holiday shopping. If you know that you like to get different and unusual gifts, not like a shirt or something that might warrant fitting or being returned, for example, if you're getting them a personalized item, you know, maybe something with their family name on it that they'll display in their house, you can do this stuff now while you find things on sale. So those are our tips. Take inventory, buy seasonally, and buy in advance of your need. Okay, moving on to the Kids Cash Corner. Found a really interesting article. In fact, I will I'll post it on our Facebook page. And it was 10 ways that we fail our kids about money. We're going to cover three. I'm kind of going to condense some of them. But it's a really interesting article that ways that parents kind of miss the boat in spelling out to kids what they need to know to handle money. And the, one of the first things they cite is that you make an assumption that they're going to learn it in school, which I think most people are aware that's just not going to happen. And secondly, that kids are just going to figure this out and grow into responsible adults. And again, just because you're older doesn't mean you're wiser. If you've not practiced these skills or been aware of what you need to do and haven't tamed your behavior, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, and it's, I just find it very funny that money, which is one of the most important things that you need to know about, it affects all aspects of your life, is just ignored, you know, the education. And everything else, people understand that it takes a lot of time and effort to become good at something. But for whatever reason, people just ignore this concept of money, which, like I said, affects all aspects of your life, and expect people to perform well. And, you know, the results speak for themselves, because the average person's, you know, retirement account balance, their decisions with debt and other facts and budgeting are awful. So the results are very clear that this is needed to be done. And like I said, it's like anything else you want to become skilled at. You need to devote time, energy, and effort into it. And obviously very little is devoted by most people.
And a lot of times I think parents get caught up in what their child is going to study and what profession they're going to pursue and how lucrative that profession is, and yet they fail to see that if you're not good with money, the income really doesn't matter. And we see this a lot with investors. We've had investors with sizable portfolios that have very modest salaries and modest means, and they've just, you know, delayed gratification and made saving a priority and did the right thing. And we've seen clients that earn quite a bit of money and actually are kind of behind on where they should be and have some catching up to do. Certainly we have all. I mean, there are some earning modestly that are spent overspending and some that are earning well and saving well. But my point is, just because you're successful in your career doesn't mean you're going to be successful with money if you don't know what to do. So here are some tips that we can give you to implement in your household that will help your child be better at this as they grow older. And the first one is, don't let them have everything that they want. They don't understand that choices are a part of handling money, and they just assume that whatever they want, they can get as soon as they want it. They're going to grow up to be very impulsive, and being an impulsive consumer is a very dangerous thing, especially if it's with complete disregard for any kind of budget. You know, delaying gratification actually, you know, it's like building a muscle. You actually have to develop the discipline to say no and not indulge your every whim.
Yeah, I mean, it's
like overeating.
Yeah, but again, you have to be conscious of it and
yes,
have good sources and have good habits, and just like exercise, know how to, you know, train properly, know whose advice to follow. It's like anything else, and, you know, people will spend inordinate amounts of time, you know, maybe getting tennis lessons and know nothing about their retirement accounts, which, you know, is pretty, I question that. It's just, it's very bizarre when you really think about it.
So if it's, you know, your child's birthday or a special occasion and you're going to give a gift or they're wanting something, you know, set a budget. Give them a dollar amount that you're willing to kick in, and then it's up to them how they allocate that. So it forces them to choose. They're probably not going to be able to afford everything on their list. Some things are going to have to get left off, and that's okay. You actually want that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
secondly, make them work and make them contribute some of what their earnings are to saving. Get them in that habit of putting some away. And as an aside, if they're not old enough to work, but they're getting gift money, for example, same thing. Don't allow them to spend all the gift money. Some things need to be put to the side. Mm-hmm. But if they are of a working age, and it doesn't have to be, you know, working papers age. It could be somebody, you know, you could be a mother's helper or rake leaves or shovel snow. You know, work is really, should not be looked at as a hardship or an annoyance. It's a really great way to let your child feel the sacrifice of their time and then to also see what that equates to in the dollar world. So suddenly that $50 video game that they think nothing of asking for, which to them doesn't seem expensive, might seem expensive if they've had to work, you know, over 6 hours at minimum wage to afford that game. Now suddenly they may not even want that game if you say, hey, look, you got to work and then you're going to buy it. So we encourage you to look at ways that you can make them part of the adult world, so to speak, by working and contributing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and don't forget, kids today, they really like expensive things like phones and
yes.
and electronic gadgets, some things that have monthly charges.
Yes.
Or a car. Maybe they're driving your car. You know, yeah. Maybe they're in charge of filling it up or contributing towards the insurance.
Right. They have to. It's, you know, it's like the old saying goes: no one, you know, washes a rented car. If you don't have some skin in the game or ownership of something, you tend not to make the best decisions and also not take care of it the way it should be. So teaching that habit early on is much better than learning this the hard way later on.
And finally, teach them the power of compound interest. Down deep inside, kids really do want money. I think they look at it as this adult thing that they're kind of not involved with. So if they can have money, it makes them feel mature. And if they can see the power of money earning on itself without them even raking any leaves or babysitting or doing any of that
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly. Money just doesn't magically appear, but I think that's how a lot of people might view it if they don't have to work for it.
Right. But if they see it compounding effortlessly,
mm-hmm.
and then as you encourage them to save whatever they're earning,
right.
it makes it a little easier for them
right.
to be
well,
disciplined
right.
right away.
And it's just in basic economics, people respond to incentives. That's how you get people to do stuff. So the incentive would be, wow, my account is growing, and when they see that growing, they tend to want to put more money into it rather than spend money. So just that lesson alone would be invaluable.
It makes them
future.
Prioritize differently.
Exactly.
And suddenly the money becomes more valuable.
And you don't talk to them about, well, your retirement, because what kid cares about their retirement? You say, this will buy you freedom. Everybody understands freedom. You tell them examples. You know, there's people 50, 60, 70 years old who have to work at jobs that, you know, might be not the best jobs in the world, but they have no choice. So by doing something like this, you'll have freedom later on to decide where and when you want to work.
Yeah, and if you want to start your own business.
Right,
it gives
do
them
or
that.
Not work,
yeah.
or whatever.
So we hope you find those helpful. I will, like I said, post the article on Facebook. And if anyone isn't on Facebook and wants a copy of the article, feel free to email me at Dina, D-I-N-A, at ATIinvestment.com. Okay, so we've got about 6 minutes left. I think that's good to discuss
yeah,
the insurance. Next month, our theme is common investor mistakes in general. So we're going to have a whole month of investor mistakes, and this month was insurance. So we thought what better way to segue into next month's theme than to end this month with common mistakes that people
yeah.
make with regards to insurance.
There's a lot of mistakes.
And it's easy to make because insurance is confusing. It's
yes.
written in its own language.
Yes, and it's meant to be confusing.
Yes, unfortunately, you're right. So one of the most basic mistakes that we see a lot is simply not having enough coverage.
Yeah, I mean, people, you know, hear numbers. Oh, I have $100,000, $200,000 worth of insurance. That's okay. You know, maybe your salary, you'll get your salary or double your salary or whatever it is. Well, let's think about it. If you have kids and maybe the kids are 10 or 11 years old, you're going to need at least 10 years of your salary. Plus, you know, possibly if you wanted the mortgage paid off and if you wanted to pay for their college education, now you're talking in the millions of dollars. So, you know, that insurance policy you might have might cover 1 or 2 years of you not being there. So that, in effect, is not insurance.
And if you combine not having the right coverage with the second mistake, it's kind of a deadly combo, and that is not having the right type of coverage. In that you view or you're treating insurance as an investment and not what it is, which is insurance.
Exactly. When you buy your home insurance and you buy your car insurance, no one is thinking how much money you're going to make off of that insurance. You're very happy to pay those premiums and have nothing happen. Well, it should be the same thing with your life insurance. But it's not, because of the way it's marketed and because of the amounts that could, you know, be purchased. There's great incentive with the way the commission structure is set up to mislead you. There's insurance and there is an investment. And when you mix the two, you have usually end up with a big problem. So except in some very few cases, would be you purchase a large amount of cheap term insurance, which you'll hope you'll never use, which would be a good thing, but you would have the insurance if something bad did happen. And the money left over that you would have used to pay for that expensive premium on the whole life policy could be used for low-cost investing. So in the end, you get the best of both worlds. You'll be adequately covered with your insurance and can sleep at night, plus you'd be able to fund your future retirement and other goals and needs. So, yes, it becomes very problematic when those two are combined and also very expensive. And the only people who usually win by that are the people selling you those products. And that is why many people own them, because they're sold and not bought.
Not knowing the cost actually piggybacks right off your point. And that's a third mistake. A lot of times people will buy policies, will have really no sense of what's going to the fee. And they're surprised to see that early on in the life of the policy,
it takes a long time.
It's not worth much. And it's not worth much for the simple fact that the commission was taken right off the top. And these commissions can be fairly high.
Yes. And insurance is usually invested, you know, their money is invested in more conservative investments. So you're not going to get a large return to begin with. And what's really sad about this is many times these insurance whole life policies are marketed for people saving for college. Now, if the child is 5 or 6 years old, it basically is going to take 10 or 15 years for you to get back that money that you paid in the commission. So now, 10 or 15 years from now, you're going to actually be needing to use the policy, and you haven't really earned any benefit from it, because the first several years of those policies are kind of just a way to you have to wait, because those returns are being offset by all the fees and commissions that you paid up front. So you have to understand that. And like I said, using a life insurance policy may sound like a good idea from the insurance side, but it is really not a good way to finance someone's college education.
And it would seem to me that if you get a term policy and college planning is one of your worries, opening up a 529 plan
again
makes better sense, because that you'll have regardless of whether
you
live or not.
Right.
It'll be there when the
child... You invest the rest. You go, you know, that's always... Like I said, there are some very high net worth people that you could do things with certain insurance contracts, but in that situation. So term insurance, I would say probably for over 90% of the people that are out there, is the best way to go.
And don't forget, if you do find out that your policy is expensive, do not simply stop paying the premiums, because you lose in that case.
Right.
The policy becomes null and void. They still have your money. Everyone loses. Whereas you can do a 1035 exchange and get something more affordable and solve it that way. Yes? So we want to thank you very much for joining us this week. Again, next month is going to be Investor Mistakes. Feel free to email us your investor mistakes. Maybe we can dissect them
and talk
about that. So Have a wonderful weekend and enjoy. See you next time. Be well.